This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
God, there's way too many cameras in here.
There are, aren't there?
And you look up there and you're like, God, I can be seen from every side.
I tell you what, you're not going to get to nick one of those coasters. I don't know if you've seen the coasters with David Luiz and Diego Costa on them.
I have not seen them.
We'll get the coasters out in a bit.
They're good.
You're saying I can nick one or I can't?
No, you can't nick one. And you'll get found out by
that's true, yeah.
By that. So there you go. Right, let me see. We are starting at 3. El Clasico at the weekend, and it kind of had a clear run with the postponements in Serie A. So it should have been the centrepiece of our European football weekend, and it was in prime spot on Sunday night. I don't know about you guys, Miguel, I felt a little bit disappointed by it.
Yeah, it's amazing how much it's dropped off, given as little as 2 years ago. It was very much not just the kind of the most famous fixture on the planet, but also the most entertaining and highest quality, where we had all those kind of last minute messy winners and everything, explosive football. And now it just seems so pedestrian, and it's really, really dropped off. I went to actually my first in December, which is the first nil all since 2002.
So it's your fault then.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Not that in the infrastructure of both clubs. But this was along a similar vein. And it just felt, one thing that really struck me more than anything, especially given the pace of the past, was how slow it was.
I mean, it's felt, Nicky, hasn't it? Like it's been coming, really, because these two teams are, these two clubs to an extent, are in a period of transition. But is this the moment where we realise just how profound that transition was? Because especially coming after a week when, okay, Barcelona got themselves in a spot where they'll probably qualify for the last eight of the Champions League, but they were far from impressive in Napoli. But Real Madrid put themselves in a position, and even bearing in mind some of the poor home results they've had in Champions League knockouts in the Zidane era, it's going to be a steep climb for them to get back into this against Manchester City. Is this the game where we really got a sense of where these two are at, and you know, reality really bit?
I don't know. I feel like it's been creeping. I think that you certainly couldn't have watched that Barcelona Napoli game you referenced and thought, wow, this is the Barcelona that used to, every time Barcelona came to Italy, it was literally always the same repeated front page headlines about Martians, obsessed with Martians in Italy, and Barcelona always the Martians. And there was nothing extraterrestrial about that team, not even Leo Messi. And actually, In that game, I felt like the plan was almost to not do the thing that everyone would expect and sort of double, triple mark Messi, which Italian teams have done before, but just crowd the middle of the pitch. And that gave him a lot of space on the flanks if he wanted it. And look, as you say, they got a result in the end that was fine, but it was nothing sparkling. There was nothing brilliant about it, very sterile. And I think that both of these teams feel slightly sterile. And it's interesting because it's sort of in different ways. We were talking just before we came in about the idea of Barcelona was always that Barcelona were the collective. Real Madrid were the team of the great, the Galacticos, the individuals, the stars, but Barcelona were this collective. And there's, you can't blame it just on Setién, although I don't think Setién's doing a good job because it predates him, but there's no great idea here anymore. There's no great unifying sort of feeling to this Barcelona team there was before. So it is, maybe Messi will do something great. And you know, there's certainly talent there. I mean, God, you wouldn't have sort of, at the beginning of the season, looked at the idea of a Messi-Griezmann front two and thought, well, that's not going to get you goals, would you? I mean, that's a great front two, but there is no sense of an idea here. So what you have is some individual players who look great. Meanwhile, I look at Real Madrid and think, well, are there even great players here? Where are the Galacticos?
Yeah. Well, this was the quote from Gerard.
The only one,
yeah.
Yeah, Eden Hazard, who this week has been in Dallas, actually, where apparently he's getting ready for an operation. Anyway, he got to watch Doncic versus Williamson yesterday, so that's not bad at all. But it means his season's over, and obviously his Euros are threatened. But this is something that Gerard Piqué said afterwards, that he got some shit from, especially from Sergio Ramos, who didn't take it well, as you would expect. Piqué said, it's one of the worst Madrid teams I've faced at the Bernabeu. I'm not saying it as a criticism of Madrid. We have our problems too, and we're not in good shape. We've missed an opportunity. Now, I always feel when we're discussing El Clasico, whether it's prime El Clasico, when we go back to Guardiola, Ancelotti, first spell of Zidane, guys like that, or whether it's a situation like now, we always have to start talking about the losers because it has such ramifications going forward. And we're going to have to do that again because we've got to ask, is the Setién reign falling apart already? And, I mean, you've talked, Miguel, about him meeting some sort of, you know, idealistic criteria. But it was funny. There was a lot made of that video on the touchline of him and especially his assistant, Eder Sarabia, having that kind of sweary tirade.
Yeah.
And we were trying to work out who they were talking about. They were when they're going, just give it, just give the ball, just give it. It was all a bit, you know, the Trogs recording Wild Thing.
But
is that a sort of suggestion really of what's wrong is not, as Nicky was saying, you know, it's not all down to Setién, but it's not Setién and his coaching staff. It's the fact that these little princes are beyond being criticised now.
There is a little bit of that, and I suppose so much, and that's interesting, I suppose, in the context of what Messi felt he had to put out with the Eric Abidal controversy a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And there's two things. But before, I just to touch on Nicky's point about Messi, and and he didn't look extraterrestrial himself. And although he might have been carrying an injury, which would maybe suggest about how he walked into the ground, this is the first time I've ever watched Messi and thought, is this actually the beginning of the end now? Is this, I mean, obviously he's not like, he was never going to maintain the same pace he did kind of when he was like almost a sonic ball of energy around 2011. Mm. And he's adapted his game. But he's always had the burst of pace over the first 5 yards. He often sees him beat so many players to so many balls. And that felt missing. And he just felt he was just a little bit constrained. And it was the first time I was struck by the almost mortality of Messi in that way. And if you look at it, then it felt like he had to keep dropping back into the centre to try and just get the ball and make something happen. And that felt much more like the Argentina Messi than the Barcelona Messi.
Is that the issue, really? That he has to pick up the ball so far from goal? And even 5 years ago, he could, when Barcelona last won the Champions League, he could do that more comfortably. You think of how he played in the 2015 final in Berlin, and he was dropping into that role just shy of the centre circle. But when you've got those runners past you, when you've got Suarez and Neymar in prime form, but now you've only got Griezmann, and he's still trying to find his way.
Exactly. And even the fact that Messi has to do that points to kind of this
hole,
problem of a structure. And that's when we come back to this about Setién's approach and how the players are responding to it. Because there's obviously now the big discussion is whether Setién can handle the personalities and all that, which I think is a fair discussion. But one of the reasons he was appointed, or sorry, one of the notional reasons he was appointed, and one of the reasons why Barca have always set themselves against the modern Madrid, certainly since, you know, Cruyff took over and Guardiola kind of rehabilitated and all that, was they felt they're an ideology club, and that the stature of the manager didn't matter so much as long as he fit into the ideology. And that's why they have made some left field decisions as regard manager. I mean, even going back to Rijkaard in 2004, despite having had that relative success with Holland as national team manager. But now it feels that they've become such a massive kind of superstructure of a club with all these huge personalities and huge wages that they can't be that sort of ideology anymore. They've become like Madrid, and they need a psychologist who can manage the players.
And what about Real Madrid, Nicky? Because you were saying, you know, how many great players have they actually got? I mean, that was one of the takeaways I felt from the Manchester City game last week, which we touched on last week's show. The fact that we talk about the possibility of it leaving Messi. I was definitely left with the feeling after that game against Manchester City that not just that Modric was not what he was, but it's really leaving Modric, you know. And it felt that they were vulnerable in midfield because of him. I mean, there's no doubt that Fede Valverde has been more and more important for them as the season's gone on. But I guess you could ask, does it say something about Zidane's Madrid? And they've always been more circumspect than people have wanted to readily admit. Does the fact that Fede Valverde is arguably their most important player in the centre of the park say that this is an uninspired side, and that Zidane is not really bothered about that in terms of the way he wants to approach things?
Yeah, I'm sometimes sort of reluctant to throw away players when they get older in the way I think we sometimes can, just because I think if you look at, say, someone like Andrea Pirlo, we all thought he was done at Milan. It wasn't just that Milan were being idiots.
He had several reinventions, didn't he, really?
But I mean, when Milan discarded him, yes, there was some sort of sentiment attached to it. But the idea that he was going to go on and have the years that he had at Juventus after that, I think would have been outside of what most people thought was realistic. Mm. So Modric, perhaps it's a case of situation, a case of needing lots of things that go into that. A new motivation, a manager who's willing to put you in the positions exactly where you need to be. In Messi's case, I'm certainly reluctant, just to call back to what Miguel was saying. Like I'm reluctant to say that we're seeing the beginning of the end, because I think, look, even earlier this season, we were looking at Cristiano Ronaldo going through a really dull run and thinking, God, has he lost something? And it turned out, no, he was just injured, because then he went and scored 11 consecutive games.
So. It's an age thing, isn't it? When you hit a bad run at this sort of age, people are going to start asking the question. It's reasonable for them to do so.
I'm not writing Messi off in a way. It's more so just being struck by his mortality for the first time.
Yeah.
And maybe it's a reflection more of myself. And a player that's been...
We're all getting old.
Yeah, that's exactly, yeah.
Well, that's the hideous part of all this. Mm. You look at all these people and start talking about them as old footballers, and they're all younger than me, certainly.
They've been at this point before, really, haven't they? Because you talk about that moment where you become aware of Messi's mortality. Mm. I always think of the first leg of the 2013 Champions League semi-final.
Oh, yeah.
Where Messi looks like he's got nothing in the tank. And that really provokes them to go off and buy Neymar and eventually buy Suarez, because they realise that they've got to have these runners around him. I mean, obviously, Barcelona have a difficulty because they have money tied up in Coutinho, money tied up in Dembélé, money that they don't look likely to get back in a hurry. If you're looking towards the second half of this season, and I kind of sense that, well, not the second half of this season, the final straight of this season and the summer, how do you approach this if you're Barcelona? I mean, I guess it's anyone's guess because they're in absolute shambles upstairs. But the fact that almost... Setien and Sarabia have been set up as fall guys when they've been parachuted into this no-win situation. I mean, what does that say about what Barcelona can do over the next couple of months?
Yeah, it does feel as if they need a kind of a 2003-style reboot. And then again, maybe almost an 08 Guardiola reboot, because there's that much wrong. And because the weird thing is...
Third spell of Van Gaal, maybe?
Yeah. But despite everything we're talking about here as well, I mean, they supposedly started this process by bringing in players like Frankie de Jong in the summer, but it's just, it all feels so cosmetic with them. Mm. And yeah, you keep coming back to this, that they've become exactly what they railed against for so long. They're just another, I
think that's exactly it. That idea of the cosmetic patch. Like, it just feels like everything is a sticking plaster, and you can do that for a while, especially when Messi is being brilliant. But I think that maybe Messi not being brilliant, even if it's only for a few weeks, exposes, like, that this whole sort of edifice is actually just being held together by duct tape at this point.
Well, that's, I guess, always the thing when you go back and judge the reign of Ernesto Valverde. You can look at it two ways, can't you? Like, very few people look at it like this, but the idea that he created the conditions for Messi to be arguably his best ever self. Mm. And the other way of looking at it is Messi propped him up the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Messi dependencia.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was truer then than ever was, yeah.
Yeah.
Og så er han konsekvent i sin indgriben. Han har stået en stor kamp, synes jeg, Mogens Krogh. Ole Bjørn, selvfølgelig. Og igen usikkerhed viser David James.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Lazio top for the first time in 10 years. There weren't a lot of Serie A games last weekend, Nicky, but reliably enough, they beat Bologna. And how big a moment is this for Lazio?
It's huge. And they were going to be top briefly anyway, because they played on Saturday and the game between Juventus and Inter was originally scheduled for Sunday. So they're going to have that moment. But it's become a longer moment because of the subsequent postponement of that game and the sort of general chaos going around Italian football at the moment. But I think it's huge. I think it's huge. People have been asking me, and I know we're going to get on to talking a bit more about like what's actually happening with coronavirus. People have been asking me who's been the sort of winner at this point, who's benefiting from this. Mm. It has to be Lazio, because they're top of the table and they have no European commitments. Whereas both Inter and Juventus potentially have incredibly congested calendars coming up. So it's real what's happening right now. Lazio are in the driving seat. They're in the driving seat, not by some sort of incredible accident. Yes, if you go through the whole squad, player for player, no question, Juventus have a deeper squad, Inter have a deeper squad. But if you go through the starting 11s, Lazio have the best midfield in that group, in my opinion, without a doubt.
And the most informed midfield, certainly.
And
they've got the most variety.
Yes.
They've got the most zest to them. Mm. I mean, tell us a bit, we've briefly touched on it before, but tell us about the return to form of Sergei Milinkovic-Savic, because he's a player who a lot of people looked at. I think it got to a point where it looked like he would leave. He certainly had set his mind to leave, but it seemed that Lazio grossly overestimated the market out there for him. There only seemed to be an appreciation inside Italy of how good he was. But this season, he's looked the real deal again.
Yeah, well, I suppose it depends whether you want to, how much credit you want to give to Claudio Letito and Unitare. Were they...
Not really, but please, go on.
Hugely naive? Were they hugely naive about what his market value was, or were they just setting themselves up for this moment by pricing him out of the market and therefore ensuring that 2 years down the... Look, 2 years ago, I think he'd sort of burst onto the scene and genuinely caught a few people's eyes. And that's when Letito comes up with this extraordinary 100 million euros figure, which at the time did feel very ambitious for him, even though he'd had a real sort of interesting breakout season.
Sure.
Then last season, he was really off the boil for most of it. What's fascinating to me is that, in my perception, he was off the boil for most of the season. And certainly he was below the levels we'd seen 2 years ago. But he still got voted as Serie A's midfielder of the year. And when you were looking at the time, it was not that easy to pick an alternative to him. So even in a bad year, he was still, you know, arguably the best midfielder in the division. This year, I think he's absolutely flying. And it comes to lots of things. I do think the stability of that team is such a huge part of it. I think that Simone Inzaghi has had time to get exactly what he wants from this team. We talked about Barcelona maybe losing this idea of a collective. I think Lazio have this idea of a collective so very firmly in hand at the moment. And that comes to the fact that your only real change over the summer was bringing Lazzari, who was a nice signing, and everything else stayed together. Milinkovic-Savic is an extraordinary footballer, because I realise I've been talking about everything but him now, and you actually asked about him. He's an extraordinary footballer. He, you know, the thing that has always been his selling point, the thing that catches your eye about him, is that he's big. Like, he's really big. And yeah,
he's big for a player with that much technical ability.
Exactly. You notice, yeah. I know it's like the good touch for a big man, but it's, yeah, we're not talking about
a striker.
Peter Crouch, no. Good touch for a big man. We're talking about genuine technical excellence. And I think when you, yeah, some of the things that he does in tight spaces with that sort of 6'2", 6'3" frame are extraordinary. But at the same time, he's very physical and able to not get buffeted off position very easily at all. He is slower than you would like. You know, of course, you're not going to have everything. And I think that if you're asking for what he does for you defensively, sometimes that's where he gets exposed. But the way this Lazio team is set up, which is to play deep. And it's fascinating to me that two of the top three teams in Italy this season are both doing the same thing, Lazio and Inter, which is play deep and look for the vertical, for the vertical all the time. And it's actually the array of different options that Lazio have given themselves within that. And I think that Milinkovic-Savic is so confident on the ball. He's an excellent passer, that allows him to play very neatly in those spaces between the lines to occupy that and to be someone who can distribute it when it needs to, but also can carry it when he needs to make those breaks happen into the open space. I also think what slightly sort of has almost sort of come to the fore more this season, because for the first time they find themselves in a position now of literal front runners, and you are seeing more teams recognize they want to sit deep and just say, all right, we'll sit deep as well and see what happens.
Yes.
I think that thing I said before about Milinkovic-Savic and tight spaces becomes so important. Because when you are against a defence that just wants to sit there and you know, hide in the bunker, he gives you two things that not everyone who's a creative midfield type would give you. One, the height. He can win headers. Mm-hmm. You can put the ball into him and he can do that. And two, yeah, give it to him in a tight space and he might well unpick something, even when the team has got 10 players behind the ball.
But just on a bit of a tangent and a wider one, it is interesting as well that Lazio and Inter have gone for this approach just at the same time the events have gone so far in the direction to, you know, a real ideology direction, and with the prevailing ideology being kind of high possession and, well, high pressing, ideally.
Do you think, I mean, that explains like the voices around Juventus that have this kind of yearning to bring Max Allegri back?
I mean, there's lots of reasons for that.
If you want to get stuck into Sarri, I mean, now is the place to do it.
I mean, I don't think Sarri's face has ever really fit in Turin. I think we said that before he ever got there. But certainly I'm struck at the moment. I'm struck because we were talking about it with Barcelona and this idea of sterile possession. I'm struck that we are, I think, and these things are always cyclical. They go around and come around. But I think we're moving from one tactical moment, as it were, in European football to another. And I think that Conte and Inzaghi are more at the forefront of this than Sarri is. Sarri's had his moment almost. It's gone.
But possession has now been broken by actually a really necessary principle for that possession, which is pressing. And it's basically pressing and transition that rules all now.
And actually, that's exactly the way that Real Madrid won the Clásico, isn't it? Mm. They just pressed a little bit higher in the second half, and that made a massive difference. But I want to come back to Simone Inzaghi, a guy who only got the Lazio job really by default after Bielsa left after 2 days, as we've discussed on many occasions before. Now, I think we touched on this last week, but we were saying how Leonardo, who I guess wants to Serie-ify Paris Saint-Germain for the second time, he's got a close eye on Simone Inzaghi, Milinkovic-Savic, a couple of the other players. Do you think, Miguel, that Lazio, whether they win the league or not, and they do have this unique opportunity, especially with the unusual situation there is in Italy at the moment, and also the fact that they don't have to play any European or Coppa games. Do you think it's just inevitable that Lazio get picked off this summer, coach and all the players?
Oh, completely. It is just the reality of European football, a frustrating reality. I remember looking at this a while ago in relation to, say, some clubs like Monaco that have gone far in the Champions League or in the Europa League. Clubs are picked off now quicker than they ever were. I mean, it's almost as if they don't even get the full year to actually do something special.
To enjoy the Champions League lap of honour.
Yeah, exactly. They're already just picked apart. And I think especially given all the, the undercurrents with Tuchel, I'd worry for them in that regard.
I do think it's interesting though when you look at Lazio and ask who's going to get picked off. I mean, Ciro Immobile, who is running away with the goal scoring table again in Italy, I don't think he goes anywhere. I don't see who would give him that chance now, given what happened when he was elsewhere. He's found the spot where he actually will score those goals. I could be wrong.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine him being great in another context, isn't it?
Yeah, Milinkovic-Savic, yes, I think he'll go, and I think whether or not Lotito will get the full value he wants for it, it'll be a big price. But then the other one is Luis Alberto, who actually was the one who scored and set up a goal in the most recent game against Bologna. Again, do people outside of that specific context trust him? Because Spain still don't. But he's playing really well.
Is that the whole thing about Lazio, though? I mean, you talked about, I'm sorry if I'm misquoting you, but you seem to be touching on the idea of the sum being the total being greater than the sum of the parts. And I guess that's why, if you're Leonardo, you look at that and think, I'm not going to just take one player. I maybe want to take three.
Yeah, and take Inzaghi as well to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, no question with Immobile specifically, I look at a player and think that's a player who has certain tools that are effective that were not used well in other places that Inzaghi has built a whole team to suit. And that's why you're getting, likely a 30-goal season out of him this season. Others, I think Milinkovic-Savic could compete in different contexts. Luis Alberto, I don't know. That's a really fascinating one to me. He's playing really well. But is that context-driven, or has he just matured as a footballer and become something better? That's one which might be a time will tell.
So at the moment, of course, there's the huge situation with the way they're dealing with coronavirus in Italy. Before, it was really just affecting northern Italy, but it's crept up on the calendar. And now we've got no sporting events to which the public will be admitted until April 3rd. April 3rd?
Is that
correct? And so if you can just give us a brief explainer of what's happened. As at the moment, the games that we missed last weekend are being brought forward to this weekend, correct?
Yeah. In terms of explaining what happened, I mean
this really affects game of the week.
I won't go back to the beginning because that could go forever. But in terms of what's happening now, yes, last weekend games got postponed. It was a mess because they had said on Thursday, yes, these games are going ahead and Juventus were behind closed doors. They spent another 24 hours arguing whether they could actually move it back another day to get it not behind closed doors.
Yeah.
Finally, it got postponed. And the decision now, which seems to finally be a firm decision, although, again, last week we had a decision on Thursday that got flipped on Saturday. The decision now is that because the government has said all closed doors all across the country as well, as you said, not just the north, they're going to go ahead with the games. They're going to play the games that didn't get played last weekend are going to happen this weekend. So if you played last weekend, you're actually going to get a weekend off because they're trying to even up the calendar at the moment. Because at the moment you have some teams who've played two more games than others.
So, it's essentially like non-league football, where you have teams with five games in hand over other teams.
Yeah. So Juventus Inter will be behind closed doors on Sunday night, which will be bizarre, but needs to happen. That's all hopefully clear, and hopefully we don't get any more of the sort of behind the scenes lobbying that caused everything to get a mess last time. The problem you've got is that even with that happening, it's just not clear how Juventus and even more so Inter, because they cancelled the Coppa Italia games in the meantime this week as well, Coppa Italia semi-final second legs. If those teams go far in Europe, there's literally not room on the calendar to play their games.
Are Inter the team with the biggest issue here? Because they've already had the game with Sampdoria the week before last that was knocked off. Mm-hmm. They played, of course, behind closed doors against Ludogorets. So they've got a kind of handle on what the situation's going to be like. But Inter was struggling for momentum anyway in 2020. And I realise, and I want to be clear about the fact that there are far more important things than the rollout of the football calendar. Hopefully that should go without saying. But from a sporting perspective, Inter was struggling to find rhythm in 2020 anyway. Are they the big losers in this, going back to your first point?
I think it's tricky because, on the one hand, yes, they've got the most games to play now out of the teams chasing the title. They've got two games to catch up. They have the Europa League calendar. They have the Coppa Italia semi-final. They have the most impossible calendar. On the other hand, they're going to get to play Juventus, who have lost five games this season, but have won all but one at home and drew that one, which they didn't win.
Yes.
They're going to get to play Juventus behind closed doors. On the other hand, would it have been nicer to play Juventus really tightly, closely removed from that terrible performance against Lyon? Maybe the Juventus have had some time to iron some things out in the interim. On the other hand, you could say Inter have only played a couple of games in the last 2 weeks against Ludogorets. They rotated heavily. So for this time of season, their legs are as fresh as you're ever going to imagine them being.
For sure.
They won't be by the end of May. At the moment, you're looking at nine games in May or something like that. But now, for this biggest game, maybe. So you can go back and forth. I do think that when you look at it, Lazio are the team that have benefited the most because they get to be top and put the pressure on everyone else. And again, no European congestion. They're looking at a maximum of, barring more postponements, they're looking at four games in May against Inter playing potentially nine. I think that's going to be huge impact on the title race.
Miguel, does the extraordinary situation that's happening worldwide at the moment, does it almost give a bit of room to Sarri and Antonio Conte? I don't think for a minute Antonio Conte's job is under threat.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's going to be able to say, look, this is a situation that was taken completely out of our hands. It doesn't feel like the normal post-Christmas flop that we've seen in the second spell of Mancini and under Spalletti.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it is just how disruptive this is and how outside the norm is actually almost a bit difficult to compute. And it will kind of scramble maybe our, it is quite odd to talk about this in these sort of respects, given its huge, obviously, human impact.
Yes.
But the fact of the matter is, it will affect football, and not just the football calendar, but the very kind of running and dynamic of the game.
Does it give a patience to some of these clubs that maybe you wouldn't have in other situations?
I was almost going to say, right, the situation is so outlandish that it almost feels like you have to kind of reserve judgment on what actually happens in this period.
Yes.
Because it's so outside the norm of what players and squads and clubs have to deal with, and can have all sorts of unimaginable effects. Or not so much unimaginable effects, but effects that you just wouldn't expect. It just kind of scrambles things so much that it is maybe a little bit unfair to judge people in this context.
I think that's absolutely true, and you know, so many consequences that knock on that we still haven't talked about. Atalanta were having a completely unrelated argument before with Lazio about they wanted their game against Lazio in the league to be played on Friday, so they'd have more time to prepare for the game against Valencia. Instead, that game's now not happening because those teams played last weekend, so they're going to have the week off. Meanwhile, so they'll get extra time to prepare Valencia. Meanwhile, this Valencia game, from what I understand, is a good chance, even though it's in Spain, it's going to be played behind closed doors, which means no home fans at the Mestalla. Of course, they're 4-1 up, but that was, you know, still potentially a big factor. So there's loads of impact now on the competitive side of
things. Valencia are very on edge about this because I think three of their fans and a journalist have been quarantined since coming back from the first leg in Milan, which was obviously at the San Siro. Before we leave this, though, Nicky, I did want to look at Juventus because we always think they're champions. They're a machine. They'll just get on with things and they'll find a way. But for them, if you go right back to the start of this current Inter run, all the way back under Antonio Conte when he took them up from seventh to that unbeaten season, so much of what they've done and so much of the position they've built and the aura they've built for themselves has been round a full Allianz Stadium, hasn't it? Because yeah. Obviously it's worked for them commercially. It's clear that, you know, there are other clubs in Italy that most of them have municipally owned facilities, so they've been able to monetize things. But in terms of atmosphere, I mean, they built it probably a little bit smaller than they could have, but they took that choice so it would be full every game. It is loud mm-hmm. when you're in there. And as you say, Juventus, even when they're struggling, kind of untouchable at home, and now they have the Derby d'Italia, which is the biggest Derby d'Italia in years. There's no yeah. two ways about that. And they have this game against Lyon, where normally, despite having lost the away leg and not got an away goal, you would expect them to put it away quite comfortably. Neither of those situations are comfortable, and it's an unprecedented situation to have to do it without any fans in a place that's been a bastion of their strength.
Yeah, well, if you think about it, they have won every Serie A title since that stadium was opened. They didn't win the year before, so they won every title since that stadium was opened. Wouldn't it be a story, yes, if the first year they don't win it is the one where they don't get to have the fans in it?
Ding und der FC Schalke hat es! Der FC Schalke ist Sieger im UEFA-Pokal 1996-97.
So I was in Germany at the weekend and I saw four games. I saw tons of goals. I saw a 3-3 draw for my first game at Fortuna Düsseldorf against Hertha. It was fun even without Jürgen Klinsmann. The last one was a 4-4 draw in the second tier between Bochum and Sandhausen. I didn't get to write about any of that because of what happened at Hoffenheim against Bayern. Now, I'm sure everyone's roughly aware of what happened, that there were these banners about Dietmar Hopp, the owner of Hoffenheim, in the Bayern section. There was this stoppage. And then, in the last 15 minutes... with Bayern 6-0 up, even without Robert Lewandowski, the players decided to just have a kick around as if they were training at goals in New Malden on a Thursday night. And obviously, as well as the fact that there was solidarity for Dietmar Hopp from the players and of both teams and certainly the home fans, there was also a coordinated effort from other ultras across the Bundesliga and in the Zweite Bundesliga, because we saw a banner at Bochum when we were there as well. And it's turned into a whole discussion about ultra culture. I mean, I'm not going to go through all the layers of it, and it is very layered. I wrote about it in The Guardian on Monday, and that's on my Twitter feed if you want to look it up. But firstly, there's been a lot of what I would see as reasonable outrage amongst not just ultras but other fan groups in Germany about the fact that the game was stopped using the three-step protocol at Hoffenheim on the grounds of them being discriminatory chants. And when you go back a couple of weeks before, when Jordan Turin-Ariga was racially abused, reacted by throwing down quite emotionally a crate of drinks right in front of David Wagner, the Schalke coach. Coincidentally, he didn't mean to throw them at him. He received a second booking, was sent off. There was no game stoppage there. There certainly wasn't any kick around, although I think the 6-0 scoreline at the time might have influenced that. There's real questions over what the priorities of the German authorities are. And I think it's notable that a little email popped into my inbox this morning of Bayern against racism and they've got a very firm campaign about this, because it was interesting afterwards on social media saying Thomas Müller, for example, stepping up and saying we're not going to put up with any sort of any type of behavior like this, any sort of abusive behavior. We're not going to put up with you abusing us. Oh, and racism. Squishing it all in the same boat.
It feels like there's a real danger of conflating very separate issues there.
It does, doesn't it?
As a kind of a shield as well. When kind of abuse just gets lumped in with a very separate issue of actual racist abuse or any sort of discrimination. Yeah. And it's surprisingly simplistic, actually. Well, for the response in in German football culture, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that the ultras are continuing to discuss, obviously. And we have to say, despite the fact that German football fans, we think of them collectively getting things done for the greater good of the game. Something I noticed when I was out there, and certainly when I was at the Köln-Schalke game on Saturday night, when the banner came out in the Südkurve about Dietmar Hopp, there were fans who were booing because they wanted the ref. They didn't want the ref to just delay the game. They just wanted him to get on with the game. They're like, goodness sakes, it's just a banner. There's quite a lot of anger in the stands towards the ultras as well. I mean, Nicky, I know you had strong feelings, much as I do, about the banners of Dietmar Hopp in the crosshairs. I mean, I think that is utterly unacceptable, and we can definitely do without that.
Yeah, I mean, this is always I feel like it's a mire that you fall into when talking about ultra culture. Is like, oh, you know, fundamentally, is it okay just to sort of say rude words about someone? And generally, I think it is. Like, it has, you know, been such an embedded part of football culture that I think sort of desiring to change that is maybe over-optimistic. And I'd prefer it if everyone wasn't awful to each other, but that's fine. But I think that when you start putting someone in a graphic like that, which is sort of specifically implying, and I'm not saying that means they're literally going to go and kill someone, but that's what that implies. You put someone in crosshairs, that implies they're being shot at.
Well,
and
that's
I think that's a step beyond the pale.
I agree. And it was a bigger deal the week before because it was one of those banners came up in the curva at Borussia Mönchengladbach, and it was a couple of days after the terrorist attack at Hanau.
Yeah.
So it felt completely wrong and completely out of step with the times. And you had the sporting director of Mönchengladbach, Max Eberl, and the captain, Lars Stindl, both going up and asking them to knock it on the head. Now, the reason this is blowing up at the moment is because Dortmund fans, not just ultras, but all Dortmund fans, were banned from going to away games at Hoffenheim for the next two seasons after this season. And this is where I think fan culture in Germany does come into its own, because so when Bayern fans put up that banner, for example, they weren't saying this is an issue. I mean, their statement afterwards, when they explained themselves to the Südkurve ultras, they said, well, actually, this isn't a decision about our club. We've not got a massive problem with Dietmar Hopp, but this is about freedom. And this is about the fact that the DFB said they were going against collective punishment, and now they've gone straight back to it. So, you know, this is something that this sort of sense of the greater good, it's not something you get in a lot of other places, is it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think that ultra solidarity and the idea of us against the establishment, and the establishment is always inconsistent and always hypocritical, that is familiar to me. I mean, that happens in Italy a lot. You saw it even, this season after the death of Diabolik, the Lazio Cup Ultra, the amount of sort of Lazio solidarity, ultra solidarity you saw, that exists. That doesn't shock me. And again, I think the rhetoric of who the real enemy is being the man is quite common.
That's it. The motivations of ultras in different countries, and the, I guess, political view of ultras in different countries is very different. But I think you see that, as you say, Nicky, in Germany, in France, in Italy this season, ultras do feel as if their culture is under attack, don't they? And they're probably right.
Yes, yes, they are. Although I think that a lot of these arguments become very, I don't know what the right word is, nihilistic, self-perpetuating a certain point, which is, for instance, in this case, if you say, oh, well, why are you having a go at us for this and punishing us for this when you didn't act strongly enough against the racist incident then? Mm. That can be true, whilst at the same time, what's the answer then? Because we didn't do it that time, now we can never get better? Now we can never make steps to improve?
Everything just gets into a mire of kind of whataboutery, basically.
Yeah.
And so there's no progress in anything.
Exactly. And I think that's a thing which I've found very frustrating myself about some of the arguments that ultras make in Italy. And I think that feels like an echo to me that I'm seeing from the fans in Germany as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that in France, I think, with homophobia and the crackdown on homophobic language. It's like the ultras have said, well, okay, part of being an ultra is our freedom to say absolutely what we want, no matter how offensive it is to everyone, which also isn't right.
We're all in agreement there.
That's good.
Er ist einfach überragend, ist super sympathisch, ein ganz, ganz toller Mensch und Fußballer. Und ich freue mich, dass er heute bei mir in der Sendung ist. Jaden, herzlich willkommen.
Hallo, Nomi. Wie geht's?
I feel good. Da, 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 da.
So this week, Daniel Sturridge left Trabzonspor. He cancelled his contract and explained afterwards that's because he didn't want to continue accepting money after he was banned for the end of this season. It's been a bit of a stop-starty season. I mean, who would have thought at the start of this Turkish Super League season that Alexander Sorloth would be the ex-Premier League player who would completely light up the league?
Yeah.
But that's exactly what he's done for a team who could become champions. Sturridge, perhaps not surprisingly, has had injuries and little adaptational difficulties. And now it's come to an end because nobly, at least to a point, he's said, I don't want to keep accepting money from a club that I can't play for an issue I'm being punished for that goes way back. And of course, it was the FA appealing to an independent commission about their own 6-week ban for betting offences that's now been extended to 4 months. I mean, it's a fascinating story, this, that really has its tentacles all the way around Europe, because there was him tipping the wink to his brother and some close friends about moves that might or might not happen. One was West Brom, and one was Sevilla. Now, I find that particularly interesting, Miguel, because we all know, certainly in England and around the Premier League, it's a small community.
Yeah.
Everyone talks to each other. When you've got the prospect of a player moving abroad, and only the people who are really directly involved in the negotiation know what's going on. Is it a bit more open to abuse?
Probably, yeah, because it feels like even more insider operation. Because as you say, I mean, if it's another Premier League club, there's two sides of it, which means there's two potential spheres of discussion, and obviously that trickles out. Whereas a foreign club, suddenly one side of that is completely cut off. So it's only coming from one direction then. So yeah, I would totally agree there. But I mean, you're right, the story itself, I mean, almost as amazing as that, but it's some of the WhatsApp messages that we've seen.
Yeah, tell us.
Look real quick, player. which I think is the standout one.
That's going to be the new sign the ting, isn't it?
Yeah, that's completely it. Yeah. Look real quick, player. But and even, I suppose, some of the like, just looking through here, some of the open language that Sturridge used, I suppose, it's worth a flutter. Given what we know players are told about gambling, but also, I suppose, it shows, and to return to kind of a wider discussion here, to totally cut off the idea of players being involved in any sort of discussion about gambling when the entirety of the Premier League is surrounded by ads for gambling, sponsors.
Yeah.
It does just feel it's a, you know, immovable object against unstoppable force type thing. You can't have it both ways, and it is going to create this or foster sort of crisis. And we've all heard so many stories about, you know, even going into lower league players, obviously sometimes, and not even any sort of malicious way, but just out of almost boredom, they'll tell a mate, I'll stick some money on that for me.
Yeah, people talk, don't they? There's no two ways about this. But do you think Sturridge, Nicky, has been slightly disingenuous about the way he's reacting to this? Because he made that video, of course, where he looked incredibly contrite and upset. But there are people out there saying, well, it could have been a lot worse. He could have been banned for a lot longer.
Yeah. I mean, look, he's probably, I would be surprised if a player with Daniel Sturridge's career earnings has not taken some advice on it from someone who's told him this is the smart thing to do. And yes, perhaps he is being deliberate, shall I say, about his doing that. But then, frankly, in that situation, I think he probably should be.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. I wonder where he goes from here, really, because, you know, he's a player who was considered a really big signing for Trabzonspor.
Yeah.
But the fact that he goes to Turkey says a lot about the other clubs who would have been interested, so not just the Premier League clubs, but the likes of Sevilla, what they feel they're going to get out of him. I mean, what's he going to have to do next? Is he looking at a next move where it's not quite pay as you play, but he has to bring his basic wage down quite a lot? Where do you think he's at?
It feels like that. I mean, he's going to have to kind of cast around a fair bit. I mean, there has been some talk about MLS eventually when he go, which might suit as well, as much for the kind of a fuller break, even though it's a continent away. And also a different context of football, I suppose.
I guess the question is, if you go to the MLS, are you ever coming back?
Yeah, and well, who's done it? It's Rooney.
Rooney.
Zlatan.
Yeah.
Zlatan,
yeah.
I suppose he's an absolute exception, though, isn't he?
Yeah, it also feels, and Beckham did as well, of course, the three who have done it are almost exceptions in their own way. And also, we're talking as well, properly top class athletes who'd had full careers, whereas Sturridge has always had this kind of
peripatetic.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, I guess the thing is with those three as well, they're brought back as much for their personality and their brand as they are for their actual playing ability, right?
Yes, I mean, I think Zlatan's playing better than I thought he would, I have to admit.
He's playing better than everyone thought he would.
But in general, that's right. I mean, I don't know. I think sometimes there is a sense of snobbery and condemnation that can go with this idea of, oh, someone wants to go to a league that isn't one of the big European leagues and have a nice life. And I think, you know what? Why shouldn't someone choose a nice life if they want to choose a nice life?
I agree with you. I look at Carlos Vela at LAFC, and I know he did pretty well for Real Sociedad, but there, he's the king. Mm-hmm. He's the king of downtown LA. Of this, what is a tremendous football culture as well. I mean, we were talking about football culture, we were talking about fan culture before. What they've got at clubs like LAFC, Atlanta, I mean, is this not going to be more and more appealing to European footballers?
I mean, I also think MLS in prestige and quality does continue to gradually move upwards. It's not getting close to Champions League standard anytime soon, but like it's... You're going somewhere where the trajectory is still upwards.
I mean, it's the players that put it there, isn't it? That's the question. If they can attract more players in their prime, like, say, the Chinese Super League managed to do with the likes of Oscar and Yannick Ferreira Carrasco with money, obviously there's always been the cap and the designated player in MLS. But could this really change the balance of things? Because we know that players, and we'll find this in Italy, I'm sure, over the next little while, it feels weird to play in front of no fans, and it does make a difference. And I think it's something that happens less and less now, but certainly when you speak to players who come from abroad to the Premier League, they will say one of the biggest things, and of course money's important, but the fact that the fans are almost on top of you, that you have that sort of intensity, and they're almost at the point now in MLS where, like the Premier League was in 92, 93, where you're getting players who've, as you say, Miguel, had a full career elsewhere, or like Bergkamp have had a big move that really didn't work out.
I mean, actually, I often think about this in relation to the Premier League growth, but do you remember when Forrest signed Andreas Lenzi in 95, 96, and that was considered, wow, a player from Serie A.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, and that's not that long. And as you say, Bergkamp was already in the league. But it showed how kind of in flux the Premier League still was. Mm. There's certainly a bit of that with MLS too, yeah.
You don't have to stop there. You can carry on.
Okay.
I'm saying at the end of this point, if you want to carry on for a bit.
No, that's pretty much it, yeah.
Oh, right, okay, cool.
I don't know where, but yeah, should I continue or should I round it off?
Yeah, if you want to round it off.
But yeah, and it's still, the MLS is still in that kind of growth phase now, where it's that kind of mix of imports in terms of profile. And there is still maybe a little bit of giddiness about it when they do have players who are closer to their prime, who have done it in the Premier League, or someone like Sturridge, who's been a key player in the Premier League title race.
So, games of the week. I'm thinking, because obviously we're living in a situation where things are changing rapidly, I've actually got two up my sleeve. I mean, don't feel compelled to have two up your sleeve, but Nicky, please.
Well, the obvious one is the Derby d'Italia, the long-awaited Derby d'Italia.
Yes.
You know, it would have been the game of the week last week, and it would be the game of the week this week, assuming it goes ahead, which I think this time it will. I do genuinely believe that this time.
And it looks like Sunday night, right?
Yes, even though they messed around with it last time. And it's just going to be a surreal spectacle. I think that certainly the home game, that Inter played against Ludogorets behind closed doors felt very odd. Antonio Conte said afterwards it felt more like a Thursday evening training session than it did a game because of the lack of fans. And I think that that atmosphere for such an important game is going to be bizarre, but the stakes could not be any higher. I think certainly for Inter, if you lose this game, you're 9 points behind. Fine, you've got the games in hand, but that starts to feel very, very daunting. For Juventus, though, as well, you're coming off an awful showing against Lyon. Your manager is not popular at this point with his own fan base. There are questions about whether the players are still with him. And so if you don't get a result here, behind, away from your comfort of the noise and the support you normally get at the Allianz Stadium, it just feels really, really significant. And likewise, if they draw, then suddenly Lazio are really top. They're not notionally top, yeah. They're top top. So I think it's a huge game with so much riding on it. And you sort of alluded to it before, but I can't think of a Derby d'Italia that has had both teams in genuine title contention in since like the early 2000s. I think that there's been times when early in the season you've thought, oh, maybe they could. But this point of the season, with both of them actually in the title race, it's been a long time.
For what it's worth, I have less of an issue with Maurizio Sarri chewing cigarette ends in an empty stadium than on a Champions League night. But that's an issue for another night.
Actually, the Juve Inter, kind of that recent history you mentioned in terms of how rare it's been that they've both been at the top. It's actually a bit like Liverpool and United in that way. And that for all their two of the biggest clubs and for all their historic success, it's exceptionally rare that they're both at the top going for a title together at the same time.
Well, that's partly the way that European football's gone, isn't it? Yeah. That it's, you know, often quite a one horse race by the point we get to this time, we get to this point in the season. My game of the week, call-offs notwithstanding, is going to be Borussia Mönchengladbach against Borussia Dortmund, which will be on Saturday evening at 5:30. That will be on BT Sport. I think that's going to be fantastic because Dortmund can't afford any more rickets. Borussia Dortmund starting to come back starting to come back and look like themselves over the next little while. My backup one, just in case, is going to be Lille versus Lyon on Sunday night. And again, a lot of imperative on the away side. Lyon need to get themselves back in the race for third. They had those good wins over Juventus, as we were talking about, and St Etienne recently, and then got absolutely hammered 5-1 at home by Paris Saint-Germain in the Coupe de France semi-final this week, despite playing excellently for an hour after Fernando Marcel got sent off, really harshly sent off, actually, for a handball that certainly wasn't deliberate and from which Neymar scored the penalty to make it 2-1. After that, well, when you got 10, it turns out you get absolutely flamed by Mbappe. And it's quite comforting to Paris Saint-Germain fans to know that when Edinson Cavani's not there anymore next season, and he's the one who always scores against Lyon, now Mbappe has taken that role of always scoring against Lyon. Miguel, your game of the week.
There's two that are actually interlinked, really, in Spain. I can't quite decide them because they're that interlinked. It's Atletico Madrid against Sevilla, given Atletico Madrid are fifth, and Barca hit Real Sociedad. But
that's a tough old game for Barca, isn't it? Because Real Sociedad are like almost the opposite to them at the moment. Yeah, they're really sparky and lively and exciting to watch.
Yeah, it could completely. And there's that kind of vibrancy about them. I say, and not just in terms of how they play, but in the feel behind the club compared to the staleness of Barca right now, especially as Barca now very much need a result. Especially you'd expect Madrid to beat Real Betis. I'd probably go for maybe the Barca Sociedad game ahead of Atletico. But then I'm going to Atletico Liverpool this week, so I'm I'm almost drawn. But it's not on TV, though, unfortunately. Like,
so prep.
Yeah.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.